Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Pork production up slightly, kind of some offsets there, a little bit lower slaughter being offset by higher weights, leaving production up just a bit, 20 million pounds or so.
Chair of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board, Mark Jekinowski.
Turkey production, we reduced 130 million pounds, just kind of truing up to some recent HPAI events. Hog price forecast, we raised 25 cents per hundredweight, all in the first quarter, just reflecting recent price strength in the data. The broiler price forecast, we raised 0.3 cents per pound, reflecting expectations for strength in the second half of the year. And the turkey price forecast, we lowered 2 cents per pound down to 96.5 cents per pound, just reflecting the prices that we're observing and the fact that it seems as though there's been really no traction in the turkey market maintaining higher prices. There's some weak demand.
This is Agriculture Today.
I really think there is, but the story has to be told because people don't understand the whole story.
Iowa Representative Randy Feenstra in Nashville for the National Ethanol Conference, whether there's political will for biofuels.
I mean, you have to think about what it does for agricultural production when you talk about what we can do with sustainable aviation fuel, with growing ethanol and biofuels. It helps all of agriculture. It helps our producers. And more importantly, we want to be energy independent as a country. So this is where it begins. And then finally, if like last December, we had to do supplemental aid for our farmers. We don't want that. We don't want to give supplemental aid. We'd rather have markets for our corn and soybeans and other commodity products. And this is that avenue. And that's the story we're trying to tell is having places for our corn to go that's productive, energy independent, and helps our producers.
But specifically on sustainable aviation fuel.
I believe the will is there. You think about what happened decades ago with ethanol. Right? We had tax credits and other things. Now we don't have a single tax credit for ethanol, and it's standing on its own. So now the next step is, how can we grow this? How can we, instead of having 15 billion gallons of ethanol being made, how can we get that to 30, to 60, whatever it might be? And the future is there. And it's just we just got to create the investment. And the other option is giving a subsidy to our farmers. And really, no one wants to do that. We want to have an economic engine and energy independence, and that's what we're trying to do.
Seems to be political will for year-round E15, but can legislation find a vehicle for passage?
Right now, just like it was in December, we had it attached to the continuing resolution on the budget. And in December, we kicked that can down the road till March 15. So we got another opportunity March 15 to hook that on to the continuing resolution at that time or to the full budget if we pass that. Depends where we're going to go. But that's the vehicle right now that we're looking for. Otherwise, we'll be looking for other vehicles. But right now, that is the focus in the Senate and the House to put it on that vehicle.
And the country right now seems split on DOGE and possible cuts coming to USDA.
I'll just say this, you know, it's a new day, and we all have to understand that. Is there going to be some hiccups? Absolutely. You know, we're running through some hiccups. We had a great conversation this past week with Rollins and others of you know, obviously there's some hiccups with FSA offices and stuff like that, losing some employees, but we're trying to get that exempt. We're working through the process, and all I ask for everyone out there is just give us time. We understand that when you change administration and we want to be more efficient and effective, there's going to be some hiccups along the way. But once it gets done, it'll be amazing.
But again, going back to year-round E15, is there a backup plan?
We don't want backups, but we have to have backups. So obviously talking with the administration, along with Lee Zeldin, the head of EPA, on what this looks like to get the extension over the summer to have year-round E15. And, you know, the great thing is we're trying to get Lee Zeldin down to Iowa to show him some ethanol plants and show him how valuable and important this is to our country. Again, telling our story, not only to the administration, but to all the agency heads that affect whether it be E15 or 45Z or 45Q or whatever it might be. And that's what we're doing right now.
Feenstra, a member of the Ways and Means Committee and the House Ag Committee. Could farm bill cuts be coming?
I loved what G.T. Thompson said, our chairman, is, you know, we're not going to cut SNAP, but we might create some parameters, you know, some work requirements or some other things to make it more effective as a program. And that's what we're dealing with right now. I'm excited to get back to Congress next week and start going through that process of where we can find more efficiencies. And I think we can do it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Under the current Farm Bill, we do have, you know, different aspects to our safety net that we can consider, especially on the cotton side.
Sean Wade is with Plains Cotton Growers.
We have the FSA-sponsored programs, the agriculture risk coverage or the price loss coverage programs, known as ARC or PLC. And so those are either a shallow loss revenue type protection through the ARC program or just really a counter-cyclical price mechanism that would be delivered through the PLC or price loss coverage system. And so as growers kind of get towards planting this time of year, we've got a lot of decisions that they have to make. First and foremost is that crop insurance decision, which kind of circles us back to that insurance price, that projected price discovery period, and why that's important to us. As soon as we know that information, growers can really kind of get down to the point of making their crop insurance choices. And when they do that, they do have to keep in mind these Farm Service Agency programs because there are interactions there. And some programs are prohibited from being combined together. And as you mentioned, STACS is one of those that does have a prohibition. If you enroll in the STACS insurance program for your cotton acres in 2025, you would not be eligible to enroll on the FSA programs, ARC or PLC. I think what a lot of growers are looking at today with where the prices are and maybe some other considerations, maybe looking at something other than STACS in 2025. We're hearing a lot of discussion about the potential for the supplemental coverage option endorsement to be used instead of STACS. What that does for the grower is it provides a similar type shallow loss revenue protection or yield protection, depending on their underlying policy, to the producer that STACS would provide. But it also opens up the possibility for that grower to also simultaneously participate in the PLC program for cotton as well. So we're seeing a lot of discussion about among producers and over insurance agents about the feasibility, cost effectiveness of, you know, combining that underlying revenue or yield insurance policy with an SCO endorsement, or even possibly if they wanted to add another layer on top of that, there's another endorsement called the enhanced coverage option that gives you even a shallower kind of trigger point for some additional coverage. Now, those endorsements aren't necessarily inexpensive, but they do provide you a more comprehensive safety net, you know, when it comes to trying to protect against price declines or the combination of price and yield declines. The good thing about SCO and ECO, though, are that you can retain that ability to also participate in the FSA sponsored price loss coverage program at the same time. So, going to see, I think, a lot more SCO, ECO combinations in combination with PLC. Going into 2025 and probably a little bit less participation on the STACS side. Most of our producers have until March the 15th to finalize those insurance choices. And then a very important change this year is that FSA has shifted back the ARC PLC decision date to April the 15th. In the last couple of years, that has coincided with our March 15th sales closing dates. But FSA has decided to push that back to April 15th.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What is the value of a good bull?
Dr. Mark Johnson is an Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist.
This is an age-old question that all of us ask regardless of which side of this business we're on. If we're in the purebred sector, we want some idea of what the value of the bulls is we're going to sell. If we're a commercial cow-calf producer, we want some kind of an idea of what we're going to have to spend on those bulls. And so we always begin, as we do this update each year, of how do we define a good bull? And there's a couple of important criteria. A good bull we would define as a bull that sells with a registration paper. On that registration paper, we've got pedigree information, and we've got a full set of genetic values reported on there. Genetic values in the form of EPDs and bioeconomic indices. And in modern animal breeding, we know that there's going to be 20, 25, or 30 of those values we as producers who are bull buying want to take a look at those to see which of those are most important in terms of adding value to our next calf crop. Second criteria that we use to define a good bull is going to be a bull that's passed a breeding soundness evaluation and sells with some sort of a breeding soundness warranty. Now, different purebred breeders are going to put different terms in terms of that breeding soundness warranty, but from the buying side of that equation, we want to make sure that both those boxes are checked before we invest in a bull. So, what is a good bull worth? The age-old adage, the answer to that I would have learned as an undergraduate here at Oklahoma State University, a good bull's worth the value of about 5 calves that he sires. So what does this translate to? Well, depending on when we intend to market those calves out of a bull, we've got to dig a little deeper to see what their current value actually is. And right now, if we look at the current market report in Oklahoma, we see 5 weight steer calves selling at about $350 a pound. Translates to a value of a little over $1,800 per weaned calf. So if we sell calves at weaning, if that's our marketing endpoint in our cow-calf operation, a good bull's worth a little over $9,000 to us right now. What if we retain ownership and turn those into yearlings? Well, right now yearlings have a value of around $250 a pound. A 9-weight yearling translates to a value of about $2,300 a piece. 5 of those calves means that, well, we're looking at $11,000 plus on a bull if that's our marketing endpoint. What if we retain ownership through all the way through finishing? Right now, 1,500-pound finished cattle bringing about $2 a pound are worth $3,000 a piece. 5 of those means that a good bull's worth about $15,000 to us. Wide range of values, somewhere in there between $9,000 to $15,000. But a takeaway message from this is equally important. The longer that we're going to own the offspring out of a bull, the more value that the genetics of that bull has to us in our operation. The longer we own those calves gives us more opportunity to capture the value of those genetics. The next part of this that we haven't discussed and is harder to put a dollar figure on is what if we're going to retain daughters to turn into our next generation of cows? Well, if we do that, we're then looking at the genetic impact of that bull in the form of the replacement females he sires being with us for about 10 years down the road if we only keep one set of heifers. That further magnifies the economic impact that the value of a good bull has if we think about retained ownership.
Learn more online, sunup.okstate.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, we started in 1981. There wasn't even 100 million gallons of ethanol at that point, way back when. And to see where we've come over these years is pretty phenomenal.
Troy Breedenkamp, Senior Vice President, Government and Public Affairs with the Renewable Fuels Association at the 30th National Ethanol Conference.
We're here celebrating the 30th anniversary of the National Ethanol Conference and the 20th anniversary of the Renewable Fuel Standard. And it's just, you can't really describe the importance of that renewable fuel standard and what it's done to create this industry over the last 20 years. We went from a couple hundred million gallons per year to topping 16.1 billion gallons in 2024. We're over 10% of the light-duty vehicle fuel supply. People may or may not know it, but when you're buying E10, you're buying a tank that's got 10% ethanol in it. And the purpose originally was for national energy security. We wanted to be more energy independent back in the early 2000s, and we are proof positive that we can do that. We can do it on a renewable basis, and we can do it in a way that is highly beneficial to America's rural economy and the American corn farmer.
He also admits the industry continues to improve efficiency.
Every year we become more efficient in the way that we produce ethanol. And we do that, we measure that on a carbon intensity scale these days. But you can take your average dry mill in America today, you take its average practices that are standard practices done by many plants across the country. That ethanol coming out of that plant, that average plant, will have a carbon intensity of about 50% that of a gallon of just conventional gasoline. Half as much carbon intensity going into that ethanol. And that's accounting for everything. That's accounting for the crop being grown by the farmer and the tractor and the diesel fuel to run the tractor, all the way through the processing of that corn kernel into ethanol and getting it to the marketplace. That's how we factor our, that's how we measure our carbon intensity. And it's getting better and better all the time. Our industry's driven to be the lowest carbon fuel on the planet. Our FAME members have a commitment to a 30% reduction, further 30% reduction by 2030, and to be net zero by 2050. And I think we're well on our way to get there and probably well ahead of time.
What about year-round E15?
We were able to get very close, as I said, last December in getting the legislative solution for E15 attached to what's called a continuing resolution to fund the government at the end of the year. Unfortunately, we didn't make the final cut, but we definitely built momentum, and we've picked up on that momentum yet in this new Congress. So just last week, we saw a bill introduction in both the Senate and the House of that E15 language that would fix this issue once and for all. We're hopeful that we're going to get a signal out of the Trump administration, perhaps the White House itself, to indicate their support to get this done legislatively as soon as possible. And we think when and if that happens, we're going to have a pretty good opportunity to finally get this thing over the finish line as soon as maybe the March continuing resolution. That's our target right now, is to shoot for that. That would then precede the summer driving season and all the things that would go into effect, like the 8-state opt-out. All of that would be nullified if we were able to get this legislative fix done on the March CR. So that's what we're gunning for right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
And probably the biggest piece, you know, that folks really kind of look for out of that meeting, in addition to, you know, maybe to the price and kind of market forecast that they do, but more importantly is the acreage survey that they put together and release they announce those results at their annual meeting.
Sean Wade is with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers, the largest cotton growing region in the U.S., talks about the National Cotton Council.
And this year, certainly a little bit of a surprise, I think, to some folks, is that NCC's survey is forecasting a pretty significant decline in cotton planted acres, at least, you know, early in this decision making cycle, of around 15% from last year, 2024. So, previous year plantings were, you know, right around that 11.4 million acre mark, I think, for Upland and Pima combined, or right around there. And this year, they're well down to 9.4 million acres of cotton under that NCC survey. So that's about a 15% decline year over year, and certainly reflects the the challenges that we're facing on the cotton side, you know, when it comes to that evil combination of market prices and, you know, forecasted market prices, comparing that to expected cost of production, and just illustrating the tough situation producers have going into 2025, trying to pencil out cotton, you know, to show some kind of a profit potential under pretty tough economic conditions.
And those economic conditions showing up during the month of February, when insurance prices are set.
During the month of February, the risk management agency performs their price discovery processes to determine, you know, insurance prices for various crops heading into the new production cycle. And for us here on the High Plains of Texas, with a March 15th sales closing date, our discovery period for that projected price for insurance is during the month of February. And the process that they use is fairly simple, simply averaging the daily closing values of the December futures for 2025. And as we look at those numbers, beginning with the first day of trading in February, on February the 3rd through the 14th, we see that the average right now is running right at 69 cents. And so as we're about halfway through this discovery period, the writing is beginning to be put on the wall about what we will see, as far as an insurance price goes. And we could still see a little bit of a rally in the back half of the month, especially as maybe we get a little volatility in the market due to the, expiration of the March contract. Maybe we'll see, a little bit of movement here in the back half. But certainly looks like we're looking at a projected insurance price for crop insurance on cotton, Upland cotton, of about 69 or maybe 70 cents or so. So that's well below the prices we've seen the last couple of years where they were above 80 cents. And just makes it, that much tougher for growers, to, put together a plan as far as, what they were going to plant and how they're going to insure and construct that safety net that they're definitely going to have to rely on as we enter into the 2025 growing season.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is the honor of a lifetime to serve as the nation's 33rd Secretary of Agriculture and a privilege beyond description to have the trust of President Donald J. Trump and the opportunity to advance his agenda here with all of you.
After being confirmed as the new Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins addressing members of USDA.
That agenda is, of course, the agenda of the whole American people, among whom the men and women of American agriculture stand in the very first rank. In my confirmation hearing just a few weeks ago before the U.S. Senate of Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, I said that all Americans are important, but the farmer is the American important to all Americans. That isn't just rhetoric. It is the truth. And here at the United States Department of Agriculture, the tens of thousands of us who serve from sea to shining sea, we walk in the light of that truth in all that we do. That means first and foremost, understanding what we do and why. There is great purpose and deep history underlying our work, and it is our North Star. With it, with the knowledge that our revolution was started and fought and won primarily by our farmers, with the knowledge that the American founders understood agriculture and its stewards to be the prerequisite for democratic civics, with the knowledge that Abraham Lincoln understood agriculture to be fundamentally the business of the people in ways no other concern of government was or could be, with the knowledge that we defend a way of life and the constitutive stuff of American liberty in ways no other federal department does.
Well, let's turn to wheat and exports. Dan O'Brien's a Kansas State grain economist.
Well, the thing that's a surprise this week is domestically is a strong week of exports. We had 21.2 million bushels of wheat actually shipped out this that'd be all U.S. wheat for the week ending February the 6th. And for hard red winter, we had 4.2 million bushels, which is way up from where it had been. We're sitting at about, and hard red spring wheat, 7.2 million. Other classes did well. So we've had an up and down path for wheat. And here that in the WASDE report that was on Tuesday the 11th of February, no change in the U.S. projection for exports of 850 million. But so we have bought right now with 36 weeks or about 70% of the way through the marketing year. We actually have bought ahead about 82-83% of the USDA's projection. So that's actually good. When you look at the actual balance sheet for U.S. wheat, again, the macro trends tell the story largely. 2 years ago, the 22-23 marketing year, 30.4% stocks to use, 883 prices. Of course, Ukraine-Russia war really affected that. Then the next year, went up to 38.4% stocks to use, 696, still very, very high prices. And now with the wheat stocks to use up to about 39.6%, we're at about 555. So you've got large scale competition happening on the world stage. However, and Guy will, I'm going to put this on a tee for you to hit, Guy. There's some concerns about different parts of the world in terms of being able to keep up the pace on wheat supply.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Egg supply and prices have been in the news quite a bit lately. Prices are at record high. The daily New York shell egg price, which is an official USDA egg price collected in New York, recently passed $8 per dozen, highest on record.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekinowski.
Basically, what's driving these recent spikes in egg prices is that we've lost a lot of birds last year to HPAI, and those losses continue this year, down about nearly 20 million birds in January alone of this year. So when you remove that many birds from a flock of just over 300 million birds, that tightens up supplies and prices respond accordingly. It's an annual balance sheet, so it's not really a point in time like right now, but it assumes the total supplies and total demand over the course of the entire year. And it does not assume any additional HPAI outbreaks. Even with that assumption, it is showing some year-over-year reduction in supplies and disappearance